A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about SNRIs versus SSRIs, specifically why anyone would pick an SNRI given that the withdrawal is notoriously worse and the half-lives are shorter. His question is, what presentations, conditions, and comorbidities actually make the dual reuptake inhibition worth it? And he floats a specific comparison. If you've got atypical depression or comorbid depression and ADHD, wouldn't an SSRI plus Strattera be the most sensible play? It's a fair question. Most people hear SNRI and think harder to quit, same benefit. Why bother?
The answer is, it depends enormously on which SNRI we're talking about. Venlafaxine is the one that earned the class its reputation for brutal discontinuation, half-life of about 5 hours for the immediate release, 11 hours for the extended release, and its active metabolite desvenlafaxine is only marginally longer. You miss a dose by a few hours and you're already in the electric zaps. But duloxetine has a half-life around 12 hours and milnacipran sits somewhere in the middle. Level milnacipran, the newer enantiomer, is similar. So part of the reputation is really a venlafaxine problem, and venlafaxine became the default SNRI in a lot of prescribing because it was first to market in the class.
The SNRI category might be getting tarred by a single molecule's pharmacokinetics. That's a very psychiatry thing to happen.
And the withdrawal severity is real. There was a systematic review a few years back in The Lancet that ranked venlafaxine as having the highest discontinuation symptom burden of any antidepressant studied, worse than paroxetine, which is the SSRI everyone already complains about. But that doesn't mean the entire class is pharmacologically useless. It means we need to be precise about which drug for which patient.
Alright, so let's get into the which patient part. The core pharmacological difference is that SSRIs are selective for serotonin reuptake inhibition, and SNRIs add norepinephrine reuptake inhibition on top. The obvious question is, what does the norepinephrine actually buy you?
This is where it gets interesting, because the theory of what norepinephrine does in depression has shifted a lot. The original logic was straightforward. Norepinephrine is involved in energy, motivation, and alertness, so adding noradrenergic activity should help with the low energy, low motivation presentations. And there's some truth to that, but it's not as clean as the early pharma marketing made it sound. What we know now is that norepinephrine reuptake inhibition also has downstream effects on pain processing, on attention networks, and on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So the clinical scenarios where SNRIs actually shine tend to be ones where those secondary targets matter.
Walk me through the pain piece. That's one I hear mentioned as a differentiator, but I've never understood the mechanism.
The descending pain inhibitory pathways in the spinal cord, the ones that run from the brainstem down and modulate how much pain signal actually reaches your brain, are heavily dependent on both serotonin and norepinephrine. Serotonin has a role, but norepinephrine is the bigger player. When you block norepinephrine reuptake, you're essentially turning up the volume on your body's own endogenous pain suppression system. This is why duloxetine got FDA approval for diabetic peripheral neuropathy, fibromyalgia, chronic musculoskeletal pain, and osteoarthritis pain. Venlafaxine has decent evidence for neuropathic pain as well, though it never got the formal pain indications. Milnacipran is actually approved in the U.S. specifically for fibromyalgia, not even for depression, though it is used for depression elsewhere.
If you've got a patient with depression and chronic pain, an SNRI is doing double duty in a way an SSRI simply can't. That's a clean use case.
And chronic pain and depression are profoundly comorbid. Something like 30 to 50% of chronic pain patients meet criteria for major depression. If you give them an SSRI, you might help the mood, but you're leaving the pain untreated, or you're adding a separate pain medication with its own side effect burden. An SNRI potentially addresses both with one drug. That's genuinely useful.
What about the attention piece? The prompt specifically asked about depression plus ADHD. Wouldn't an SSRI plus Strattera make more sense there?
Strattera, atomoxetine, is a relatively selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It's not an SNRI. It has minimal serotonergic activity. The logic of combining an SSRI with Strattera would be that you're essentially building your own SNRI, but with independent dose control over the serotonergic and noradrenergic components. And there are absolutely clinicians who do this. The advantage is flexibility. You can titrate the norepinephrine effect separately from the serotonin effect.
The downside is, you're asking someone to take two medications, manage two side effect profiles, deal with two copays. And atomoxetine has its own issues. Nausea, appetite suppression, the fact that it takes 4 to 6 weeks to see the full ADHD benefit, which is a tough sell when stimulants work in an hour.
And here's the counter-argument for using an SNRI alone in the comorbid depression, ADHD patient. Venlafaxine at higher doses, above about 150 milligrams, has meaningful norepinephrine reuptake inhibition. Below that dose, it's basically an SSRI. This dose-dependent pharmacology is actually one of the class's most interesting features, and it's completely under-discussed. At low doses, venlafaxine is serotonergic only. At moderate doses, you start getting noradrenergic effects. At high doses, above 225 milligrams, there's also some weak dopaminergic activity in the prefrontal cortex.
It's three drugs in one, sort of, depending on where you set the dial.
And there are small studies. I'm thinking of one from the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry in the early 2000s that found venlafaxine improved attention and executive function in adults with depression independent of mood improvement. The effect sizes weren't huge, but they were there. Duloxetine has less data for attention specifically, but the noradrenergic mechanism is the same in principle. So for a patient with moderate depression and milder attentional symptoms, not full-blown ADHD requiring stimulants, but the kind of concentration complaints that often travel with depression, an SNRI might be a reasonable single-agent approach.
For someone with bona fide ADHD, the kind where they've had symptoms since childhood and it's impairing multiple domains, you'd still want a dedicated ADHD medication, no?
An SNRI is not going to match the effect size of a stimulant or even atomoxetine for core ADHD symptoms. The question the prompt raised is whether the combination of SSRI plus Strattera is more popular than an SNRI alone, and I think the answer is that it depends on the severity of the attentional component. For mild cognitive complaints secondary to depression, SNRI monotherapy is defensible. For true comorbid ADHD, most psychiatrists I know would treat the ADHD separately, and they might still choose an SNRI for the depression if other factors pointed that way.
Let's talk about atypical depression specifically. The prompt mentioned it. What makes SNRIs relevant there?
Atypical depression is the subtype characterized by mood reactivity, meaning the person can still feel better in response to positive events, which distinguishes it from melancholic depression where nothing moves the needle, plus at least two of the following: increased appetite or weight gain, hypersomnia, leaden paralysis, and rejection sensitivity. It's an older concept, but it holds up clinically. The interesting thing is that atypical depression has historically been considered more responsive to monoamine oxidase inhibitors than to tricyclics, which led researchers to think it might have a different neurobiological basis, perhaps more dopaminergic or noradrenergic involvement.
MAOIs are basically off the table now for most patients because of the dietary restrictions and the hypertensive crisis risk. So the question becomes, what's the next best thing?
And the evidence for SNRIs in atypical depression specifically is not overwhelming. There aren't large randomized trials targeting that subtype, but the clinical logic goes like this. Atypical depression features hypersomnia and low energy as core symptoms. Those map conceptually onto noradrenergic dysfunction. SSRIs can actually worsen fatigue and somnolence in some patients, which is the last thing you want for someone already sleeping 12 hours a day. An SNRI's noradrenergic component might be more activating and help with the hypersomnia and the leaden paralysis. Venlafaxine and duloxetine both have data showing they're more effective than placebo for the somatic and energy-related symptoms of depression. So while the formal evidence base for SNRIs are superior for atypical depression is thin, the mechanistic argument is reasonable and many clinicians find it works in practice.
That's a pattern we see a lot in psychiatry, isn't it? The clinical intuition runs ahead of the trial data, and sometimes it's right, and sometimes we look back 10 years later and realize we were all confidently wrong.
That's the history of the field, honestly. And to be fair, part of the reason the trial data is thin is that atypical depression as a distinct subtype has fallen out of favor in research. The DSM-5 moved toward a dimensional approach with specifiers rather than rigid subtypes, so the funding for large trials comparing treatments specifically for atypical depression just isn't there.
What about anxiety disorders? That's another area where I hear SNRIs mentioned as possibly advantageous.
The evidence for SNRIs and anxiety disorders is substantial. Venlafaxine extended release has FDA approval for generalized anxiety disorder, social anxiety disorder, and panic disorder. Duloxetine is approved for generalized anxiety disorder. And the effect sizes are comparable to SSRIs. They're not superior in head-to-head trials, but they're clearly effective. The norepinephrine component was initially thought to be potentially anxiogenic, the logic being that norepinephrine drives arousal, so more norepinephrine equals more anxiety. And in some patients, that's exactly what happens, especially at the start of treatment. But over time, the downregulation of beta-adrenergic receptors seems to produce an anxiolytic effect.
The activation that makes it useful for hypersomnia is the same activation that can make someone with panic disorder feel like they're crawling out of their skin for the first 2 weeks.
And this is one of the practical reasons SNRIs are used more broadly. The initial side effect burden, nausea, jitteriness, insomnia, sweating, is worse than with most SSRIs. If you're a primary care physician starting someone on their first antidepressant and you have to choose between something that's likely to be tolerated and something that might make them feel worse before they feel better, you're going to pick the SSRI every time. The SNRI becomes a second line or specialist choice.
Which feeds back into the discontinuation problem. If the onboarding is rougher and the withdrawal is rougher, the drug better be doing something uniquely valuable in the middle. Otherwise, the risk-benefit math doesn't close.
And I think this is why the clinical scenarios where SNRIs make sense are fairly specific. Let me enumerate them, because the prompt was asking for presentations and conditions where the combination drug actually earns its keep.
Oh, for it. Go for it!
First, depression with comorbid chronic pain. This is the strongest case. Duloxetine has the most pain indications, venlafaxine has good evidence for neuropathic pain, and the mechanism is directly relevant. If someone has diabetic neuropathy and depression, or fibromyalgia and depression, an SNRI is arguably first line.
That one feels uncontroversial. What's next?
Second, depression with prominent fatigue, hypersomnia, or low energy. The so-called atypical or vegetative presentation. The noradrenergic activation can be therapeutic rather than just a side effect. This is more of a clinical judgment call than a guideline-based recommendation, but it's widely practiced. Third, treatment-resistant depression where an SSRI has provided partial response. Adding a noradrenergic agent, either by switching to an SNRI or augmenting, is a standard next step. The STAR-D trial, which remains the largest real-world study of depression treatment, used venlafaxine as one of the switch options after citalopram failure, and it performed comparably to other strategies. Not dramatically better, but it's an established option. Fourth, generalized anxiety disorder with comorbid depression, where the patient has failed or not tolerated an SSRI. Venlafaxine, XR, and duloxetine both have the GAD indication, and for some patients, the dual mechanism just seems to work better. We don't have a good way to predict who those patients are. There's no biomarker that says this person needs norepinephrine reuptake inhibition, but clinically, some people respond to SNRIs who didn't respond to SSRIs. Fifth, and this is more niche, but stress urinary incontinence. Duloxetine is actually approved for this in Europe, though not in the US. The noradrenergic effect increases urethral sphincter tone. And sixth, vasomotor symptoms of menopause. Venlafaxine and desvenlafaxine both reduce hot flashes, so you might choose an SNRI for a perimenopausal woman with depression and hot flashes where you're getting a two-for-one benefit.
The hot flash thing, is that also a noradrenergic mechanism?
It's not fully understood. The leading theory is that it involves serotonin-mediated effects on the thermoregulatory center in the hypothalamus. Venlafaxine at low doses, where it's primarily serotonergic, is effective for hot flashes. So that one is less about the norepinephrine and more about serotonin, but the SNRI happens to be the drug that has the best evidence.
It's almost accidental. The SNRI got studied for hot flashes. It worked, and now it's an option. But the norepinephrine part is just along for the ride.
And desmenlafaxine, which is the active metabolite of venlafaxine, has also been studied extensively for vasomotor symptoms. It's a cleaner drug in some ways, fewer drug-drug interactions, because it doesn't go through the CYP2D6 pathway the way venlafaxine does.
Let me push on something. The prompt's hypothetical was SSRI plus Strattera versus SNRI. We've talked about when SNRIs make sense, but I want to return to that specific comparison. Is there a case where the combination is the better approach?
I think there is, and it comes down to the ability to independently titrate. Strattera's norepinephrine reuptake inhibition is relatively pure and well-characterized. If you combine it with an SSRI, you know exactly how much serotonergic effect you're getting from the SSRI and exactly how much noradrenergic effect from the Strattera. With an SNRI, the ratio of serotonin to norepinephrine reuptake inhibition is fixed by the molecule and the dose. Venlafaxine gives you a particular ratio at a particular dose, and you can't adjust the two independently.
For someone who needs a lot of norepinephrine effect, but only a little serotonin effect, or vice versa, the combination gives you control that the single drug can't.
And there are patients who are very sensitive to serotonin. They get the GI side effects, the sexual dysfunction, the emotional blunting, but who need noradrenergic support for energy or attention. For those patients, a low-dose SSRI plus Strattera might be much more tolerable than pushing an SNRI to a dose where the noradrenergic effect kicks in, but the serotonergic effects are overwhelming.
That's a useful clinical insight. It's not just which is better. It's that the fixed ratio in the SNRI is a constraint that the combination approach can work around.
The downside, which we already touched on, is polypharmacy. Two prescriptions, two copays, two sets of side effects, two things to remember to take. There's a real-world adherence penalty for each additional medication. So you're trading pharmacological precision against practical simplicity, and the right answer depends on the patient in front of you.
You mentioned sexual dysfunction. Is there any difference between SNRIs and SSRIs on that front?
The short answer is that SNRIs cause sexual dysfunction at roughly the same rates as SSRIs. Somewhere between 30 and 70% of patients, depending on the study and how you measure it. Venlafaxine and duloxetine both have high rates. There was some early hope that the noradrenergic component might offset the serotonergic sexual side effects, because norepinephrine is involved in arousal, but that hasn't really panned out in the data. Maybe a slight advantage for milnacipran and levomilnacipran, but the studies are small.
If someone's choosing between an SNRI and an SSRI, sexual side effects aren't a differentiator. That simplifies things, at least.
The differentiators are pain, energy, attention, and the specific comorbidities we've been discussing, not sexual tolerability.
What about the sweating? SNRIs are notorious for causing excessive sweating. I've had patients describe it as socially disabling. Is that mechanism understood?
It's thought to be noradrenergic. Norepinephrine activates sweat glands through the sympathetic nervous system. SSRIs cause sweating too, but SNRIs are worse, which fits with the dual mechanism. The sweating tends to be dose-dependent, and it's one of the side effects that doesn't tend to diminish over time the way nausea or initial jitteriness might. There are some tricks for managing it. Dose reduction, adding a low-dose anticholinergic like benztropine, or in severe cases, switching to something else entirely.
You know, this is where the clinical reality of SNRIs gets messy. You've got a drug that's harder to start, harder to stop, makes you sweat through your clothes, and for a substantial number of patients, it doesn't work any better than an SSRI. And yet it has these niche superpowers. Pain, energy, the hot flash thing, where it does something an SSRI can't. The art is knowing when to reach for it.
That's the job. And I think the reason SNRIs have the reputation they do, the difficult drug reputation, is that they got overprescribed. In the early 2000s, venlafaxine was marketed heavily as a more effective alternative to SSRIs, and the dual reuptake mechanism was sold as inherently superior. Primary care physicians started using it first line for uncomplicated depression, and a lot of patients had a rough time for no clear benefit. The backlash was predictable.
The marketing outran the evidence, as it does.
and the evidence we have now is that SNRIs are not globally superior to SSRIs for unselected depression. Meta-analyses show a small advantage for venlafaxine over SSRIs in response rates, but the difference is something like 5 to 7 percentage points, and it comes at the cost of more dropouts due to side effects. So, for the average patient with first episode depression, there's no compelling reason to start with an SNRI. The SSRI is the rational default.
Which makes the SNRI a specialist tool. You reach for it when the SSRI has failed, or when the specific comorbidity profile points toward it. That's a much more restrained role than what was originally envisioned.
I think that's where the field has landed. The question the prompt asked, what conditions are they actually favored for? The answer is that they're favored for a handful of specific scenarios, not as a broad first-line strategy. And the scenario where they're least favored is exactly the one the prompt identified. Uncomplicated depression with no pain, no atypical features, no treatment resistance. In that case, an SSRI is almost always the better first choice.
Let me ask about one more comparison. The prompt didn't mention bupropion, but it's the other major non-SSRI option. How does the SNRI versus bupropion decision play out?
Bupropion is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, so it's affecting norepinephrine but not serotonin, and adding dopamine. It's activating, it doesn't cause sexual dysfunction, and it doesn't cause weight gain. For the atypical depression presentation with hypersomnia and low energy, bupropion is actually a very strong competitor to SNRIs. The main limitation is that bupropion is less effective for anxiety disorders. It can actually worsen anxiety in some patients, and it's contraindicated in people with seizure disorders or eating disorders.
If you've got the low-energy, hypersomnic, depressed patient who also has significant anxiety, the SNRI might be a better fit than bupropion because it treats both. If anxiety isn't in the picture, bupropion might be preferable because of the tolerability advantages.
That's the calculus. And bupropion plus an SSRI is another combination strategy that competes with the SSRI plus Strattera approach. You get the serotonergic coverage from the SSRI and the noradrenergic dopaminergic activation from bupropion. It's a very common combination in practice.
We're building out a decision tree here. For uncomplicated depression, start with an SSRI. For depression plus pain, consider an SNRI. For depression plus low energy without anxiety, consider bupropion. For depression plus low energy with anxiety, consider an SNRI. For depression plus ADHD, treat the ADHD separately and choose the antidepressant based on the other features.
That's a reasonable summary. And I'd add, for treatment-resistant depression where an SSRI alone hasn't worked, augmentation with bupropion, an atypical antipsychotic, or switching to an SNRI are all evidence-based options. The choice among them depends on side effect tolerability and patient preference.
The atypical antipsychotic augmentation route is a whole other episode, but it's worth noting that SNRIs are competing not just with SSRIs, but with a whole landscape of augmentation strategies, some of which have stronger evidence.
And the STAR-D data showed that after two failed antidepressant trials, the odds of remission drop substantially regardless of what you try next. So the stakes of getting the first or second choice right are high, and the incremental benefit of any particular strategy after that is modest.
What about children and adolescents? Is the SNRI risk-benefit different in younger populations?
The evidence in pediatric depression is sparse and not particularly encouraging. Venlafaxine had negative trials in children and adolescents. It didn't separate from placebo, and there were concerns about increased hostility and suicidality. Duloxetine has one positive trial in adolescents, but it's not widely used. SSRIs, particularly fluoxetine and escitalopram, remain the first-line pharmacotherapy for pediatric depression. SNRIs are very much a third- or fourth-line option in that population.
The pediatric data reinforces the idea that SNRIs aren't a general-purpose antidepressant. They're a targeted tool.
The targeting matters more in populations where the side effect burden is higher or the evidence base is thinner. Pediatrics, the elderly, medically complex patients, in all of these groups, you need a specific reason to choose an SNRI over an SSRI.
I want to circle back to the discontinuation problem, because it's the thing everyone talks about, and I think it shapes prescribing more than the official guidelines acknowledge. If you're a clinician, and you know that stopping venlafaxine is going to be a nightmare, you're going to think twice before starting it. How much of the SNRI's limited market share is just the discontinuation reputation?
I think it's substantial, and I don't think it's irrational. The brain zaps, the dizziness, the nausea, the irritability. Venlafaxine discontinuation syndrome is unpleasant, and it can last for weeks. There are case reports of people being unable to work during a venlafaxine taper. And because the half-life is so short, even missing a single dose can trigger symptoms. So you're asking a patient to be absolutely adherent to a medication that, if they ever want to stop, will require a slow taper over weeks or months.
The slower the taper, the longer the withdrawal. It's not like you can rip the band-aid off. You either suffer acutely or you suffer protractedly.
There is a strategy of switching to fluoxetine, which has a very long half-life, something like 4 to 6 days for the parent drug and even longer for its active metabolite, and then tapering off the fluoxetine, which is much easier. It's called the fluoxetine bridge, and it works reasonably well. But it means you're asking someone who wants to stop one medication to start another one temporarily, which is a hard sell.
Take this new drug to help you stop the old drug. It makes pharmacological sense, but it feels like a failure of the original prescribing decision.
And I think it should prompt reflection on whether the SNRI was really necessary in the first place. If the indication was strong, chronic pain plus depression, for example, then the discontinuation difficulty is a known cost of an otherwise appropriate treatment. If the indication was uncomplicated first episode depression, then the discontinuation burden was probably avoidable.
This is where the art of medicine lives. Not in the decision tree, but in the judgment about whether this particular patient's situation justifies the known downsides of this particular drug.
That judgment requires time, which is the scarcest resource in modern medicine. A 15-minute medication check doesn't allow for a nuanced discussion about the relative merits of SNRIs versus SSRIs versus bupropion versus combination strategies. So the defaults take over, and the default is usually an SSRI, which, in most cases, is the right default.
To answer the prompt directly, when does the combination drug actually make sense? It makes sense when the norepinephrine reuptake inhibition is treating something specific that the patient actually has. Pain, profound fatigue, treatment-resistant depression where SSRIs have failed, or the handful of niche indications like hot flashes and stress incontinence. Outside of those scenarios, the SSRI is the better default, and the combination of SSRI plus Stratera is a reasonable alternative when you want independent control over the two mechanisms.
That's the summary. And I'd add one more thing. The field is moving toward precision psychiatry, however slowly. The dream is that someday we'll have a biomarker or a genetic test or an imaging signature that tells us whether a particular patient needs serotonergic, noradrenergic, or dopaminergic intervention. If that day comes, the SNRI versus SSRI question won't be a matter of clinical judgment and trial and error. It'll be a matter of matching the drug to the biology, but we're not there yet.
Until we are, we're stuck with the messy, imperfect, side-effect-laden reality we've been describing. Which is, I suppose, why prompts like this keep coming in. People want to know if there's a logic to it, or if we're all just guessing.
We're not just guessing. We're making educated bets with incomplete information. And the SNRIs are a useful tool in the kit. Not a miracle drug, not a disaster, just a tool with specific strengths and specific weaknesses that you deploy when the clinical picture calls for it.
The musical equivalent of a baritone saxophone. Not when you reach for first, but when you need that register, nothing else does the job.
And now I'm going to be thinking about which antidepressants correspond to which instruments for the rest of the day.
Duloxetine is a cello. Venlafaxine is an oboe with a sticky key.
Fluoxetine is a piano. Reliable, everyone knows how to play it, hard to get a truly bad sound out of it.
I'm going to stop us before we score an entire psychopharmacological orchestra. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early Renaissance, a now abandoned linguistic theory held that all human languages descended from a single primal tongue, and scholars trying to prove this pointed to inuktitut as evidence of polysynthetic morphology, where a single word can express what requires an entire sentence in European languages, claiming this was a preserved relic of Adamic speech. The theory was mainstream for nearly a century before comparative linguistics dismantled it.
Of course there was.
I love the idea that the original human language was polysynthetic. Adam naming the animals with single words that were actually entire paragraphs. The open question I'd leave listeners with is this. We've talked about the norepinephrine component as if it's one thing, but the adrenergic system has multiple receptor subtypes with different functions. Alpha-1, alpha-2, beta-1, beta-2. Different SNRIs have subtly different affinities for these downstream targets. Is there a future where we're not just choosing between SNRI and SSRI, but between specific SNRIs based on their receptor profiles? The pharmacology is there. The clinical evidence isn't yet, but that's where I'd be watching.
We'd like to thank our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you feel like leaving a review wherever you listen, it helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon.
Take care, everyone.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.